I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Every year, thousands of people lose their lives in highway collisions involving semis and large trucks. The technology exists to reduce the number of those crashes and save lives, but the trucking industry has been slow to adopt it. Today, we'll find out what's behind the increase in these collisions and why a possible fix hasn't been implemented. Then, a look at our relationship with technology. It does so much for us already, but are we ready for more? One engineer says there's a lot of potential, but we need more time and more research to get it right. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. The big question the Star's Mike Hendricks asked on Sunday in a story about truck safety was this: why aren't big trucks weighing up to 80,000 pounds required to be equipped with automatic emergency braking? After all, those trucks are racing along at 70 or 80 miles per hour on highways they share with 3,000-pound cars. Turns out the answer is confounding. The trucks aren't required to be mounted with those emergency braking systems. But why? We're about to find out. With us today is Mike Hendricks, the Star reporter who wrote that piece that carried this headline: lethal inaction, fatal truck crashes surge, but U.S. government won't make an easy fix. Mike, welcome back. Good to have you.
Glad to be here.
You began this story by talking about a deadly trucking accident outside of West Terre Haute, Indiana last year. What happened there?
Well, it was about 5 p.m. on the Saturday before Mother's Day. Three people in a Camry were traveling across town on the Interstate I-70. They came upon a backup and slowed to a stop. Behind them, a truck driver in a big rig plowed into them. The guy had been going along about 70 miles an hour, and he was not paying attention.
He had been billed as a pretty good driver, but at least in this moment, he wasn't.
Correct. I mean, everybody makes a mistake, and at this point, he made a big one.
What distracted him that day? Do you know what he was looking at inside the cab there?
We have video, we display that video on our website of him staring down at a tablet computer in his right hand as he steered with his left.
Turns out the number of lives lost as a result of trucking accidents is rising. Give us a sense of how many died in 2016.
About 4,300, a little bit more than that in 2016. That was up about 28% from 2009, which was the low point this century, or since they've been keeping track.
So the numbers are going up. Society sort of prides itself on dealing with issues and taking care of problems, but this one's slipping through the cracks here.
Correct. There's no one answer on why there's an increase. Speeds overall have gone up on our roads in the last decade.
And highways are more crowded, you pointed out.
Highways are more crowded because in 2009, at the low point, we were in the midst of a recession.
What are the we know the main reasons truck drivers get into these wrecks. What are the factors that lead to these things?
Well, there's truck drivers will point out, usually it's the four-wheeler, the person in a car, that they say causes the wrecks primarily. They cut them off or whatever, engage in unsafe activity. They people in cars run into the backs of trucks quite often, which may or perhaps not happen quite so much, because by 2022, all new cars will be outfitted with automatic emergency braking. Not so with trucks.
Well, that's an interesting point. So your premise in this piece was that these big, heavy, 80,000-pound trucks lack these emergency braking systems, but cars are getting them. Some already have it. Why don't trucks?
Well, there's a they're a different animal, for one thing. There's different issues with trucks, but they have perfected the technology in the last few years. For 20 years, there's been crash avoidance warning systems. And for the last 10 years, there's been automatic emergency braking that works in trucks. And right now, they can in the newer trucks, stop close to stopping on a dime these days because of those systems.
Even in heavy trucks, they can even stop very quickly.
Even in a heavy truck. I see the videos. Bendix is one of the manufacturers. They have quite a spectacular video out there that shows just how effective this is.
So the trucks, the capability, the technology is there for these trucks to have these emergency warning systems, but they're still not being installed at a very high rate.
Correct. Well, what the National Transportation Safety Board has been suggesting that the regulators at the Department of Transportation, an agency called NHTSA, that they require crash avoidance systems and automatic emergency braking, one or the other, for the last 20 years. Many auto safety or highway safety groups are behind it as well. Even the American Trucking Associations, the corporate wing of the truck industry, they are in favor of these systems, though they're not in favor of making them mandatory. One problem is the fact is that the trucking industry is divided on this issue,
mm-hmm.
but on the worth of technology. There are some wings of the trucking industry who think it should be mandatory, but when you don't speak with one voice, nothing happens in Washington.
Hmm. How much does it cost, Mike, to equip a truck with this emergency braking system you're talking about here?
Well, I'm hearing a couple $1,000s. You can't get a straight answer necessarily from some of the manufacturers I tried. There's some notion that if they were mandatory in all trucks, that the price would come down to about $500 a unit.
Wow. Okay. Well, I want to bring in Norita Taylor to our conversation. She's a spokeswoman for the Owner-Operator Independent Drivers Association. That's a group with a mission of fighting for the rights of all professional truckers. The group is based nearby in Grain Valley, Missouri. Norita, nice to have you here. Welcome.
You bet. Thank you.
Well, what's the position of your organization, the Owner-Operator Independent Drivers Association, when it comes to a requirement that these automatic emergency braking systems be installed on all new trucks?
Well, it's important to differentiate between technology and mandates. We're not against technology, but when it comes to mandates, then you're talking a different story. It needs to be proven technology, and we're just not convinced that they work.
But isn't this proven technology at this point?
No, we hear way too many complaints from our members about the braking system that do drive them with braking systems, about them going off, approaching overpasses and other instances that they feel it just makes it less safe for them.
But how can that be if cars these days are being equipped with these things? Why they seem to be working okay there? Why would it be a different story for trucks, Norita?
Well, you know, the question that your listeners really should be wondering about is why aren't truck drivers being required to be trained before they get a CDL? I don't know if you're familiar.
CDL, what does that mean?
Sure, a commercial driver's license.
Okay.
So right now, your hairdresser or your barber has more required hours of training to get their license than a truck driver.
Mm-hmm. Well, doesn't that even put added impetus on the idea that these trucks should be equipped with emergency braking systems if some of the drivers aren't all that whippy to begin with?
No, what it means is that the focus is not aligned in the right direction. We're not training drivers. We're not requiring training for all drivers. Like Mike said earlier, there's even data to back up what he said, that most of the truck-related crashes are caused by other drivers or other factors. And so what we need are better drivers.
So tell me about some of the people who are behind the wheels of these big trucks. You mean they're not trained? They're not certified? What are they then?
Well,
just
some
a guy,
of the...
a guy down the street?
Well, what you have to understand is to get a CDL, a commercial driver's license, all you have to do is go and pass the test. There's no minimum required training requirements. Now, there is a rulemaking that will go into place in the year 2020, but it doesn't have any behind-the-wheel training. And groups like us and the safety groups that Mike talked to, we all agreed in the negotiated rulemaking that was put in place a couple of years ago. We were part of that committee, and some of the people that Mike interviewed were part of that committee. And everyone, except for one group, agreed that there should be behind-the-wheel training as part of that rulemaking. And so to round that out, we just think that there should, instead of having such a hyper-focus and relying on too much technology, we need to start with the drivers. The safest thing you can put in a truck is an experienced driver.
So just to be clear here, you're saying that you want to mandate that these drivers have certain training behind them, mm-hmm. but you're not willing to stand behind the idea of mandating these automated braking systems in these trucks.
That's right.
Okay, because again, your point being that the automated systems are still untested to some degree.
Right.
Mike, does that match with what you heard as you did your reporting on this story?
What I did, the way I approached this story was, and the fact that there are myriad issues, like Narita mentions, there's a training issue. There's a lot of discussion about the hours of service, how many hours a truck driver can drive, and how often that plays into accidents. What I tried to do with this story is try a neutral approach here. And in this case, this is a technology that doesn't recognize whether it's the truck driver's fault or the car's passenger driver's fault or whether the driver's trained or whatever. It recognizes that people make mistakes, whoever it is, and that there's this technology out there that can stop a number of rear-end wrecks. Now, of those 4,300 deaths, perhaps 300 of them were killed in a rear-end truck accident in which the truck was the striking vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
And we're told and the National Transportation Safety Board says that 70% of those wrecks, those fatalities, can be avoided with this technology.
Mm-hmm. This notion, as Narita is pointing out, Mike, that it's her belief that these automated emergency braking systems haven't been fully vetted yet. They don't work all that well at some times. Does that, again, match with what you learned as you did your reporting?
There were, over in the early technology, a lot of false positives where the radar system would see a bridge abutment and think it was a car.
Right.
A lot of this stuff has been improved over the last 10 years or so. Europe, in 2009, the European Union, started or initiated a rule that all their trucks would be outfitted with this technology by 2015, and mm-hmm. they are now, all the new trucks. We're not talking about retrofitting trucks. We're talking about brand new trucks. Right now, about 40 to 50% or so of brand new trucks, semis, tractors coming off the assembly lines have this equipment. It's standard equipment, but buyers have the option of not having it.
Is it possible to retrofit existing trucks, the existing fleet that's out there on the highways these days, Mike?
It's possible to retrofit the ones that are outfitted for this. Like, there, for instance, I write about a crash in Goodland, Kansas, a year or two ago. Truck driver ran into a slow-moving vehicle. It was the slow-moving vehicle's fault. Six people died. The National Transportation Safety Board noted that truck had the plug-ins, basically. It was outfitted for, you could install the equipment in this truck for automatic emergency braking, but the owner of the truck had opted not to.
Yeah. Narita, let me swing back to you here. Are you fully convinced that today these automatic emergency braking systems still aren't up to snuff? Because it sounds like there have been problems early on, but improvements made over the years. Is it still that big of an issue, particularly if trucks in Europe are being fitted with these things?
Well, what you have to remember, trucking in Europe is very different than trucking here in the United States. We have a vastly wider territory, different types of interstates, and much heavier types of trucks. The trucks in Europe are smaller, and they're just put together differently. But we just haven't seen enough data to back up putting a mandate in place.
So how hard is your organization pushing to get the technology up to speed so that these trucks can be fitted with these systems?
Well, what we're focused on...
we're talking about horrific accidents here, Narita. I mean, it strikes me that your association should be really all about trying to rid this scourge from our nation's highways.
Well, what we're pushing for right now are revisions to hours of service, which...
what does that mean?
Sir, hours of service are the... regulations with the Department of Transportation that determine how many hours a truck driver can work and drive. And we are working to get some revisions for more flexibility and more rest, because what our members tell us is that the regulations prevent them from getting enough rest. And so that's what we're trying to make sure happens.
What's the issue there? Explain that to me a little more. How much rest are they getting? What do they need? What's happening out there?
Sure. The issue is this. truck drivers don't have control over their schedules. They are at the mercy of everyone else in the supply chain, and they're at the mercy of congestion, traffic, shippers, receivers, and weather. But they are held accountable for the number of hours. They are restricted to a number of hours that they work and a number of hours that they drive. And what they are finding is that the lack of flexibility makes them race against the clock.
In other words, they finish delivering one load, and someone else is requiring them to deliver the next load by a certain time, and they're not allowed to take a break, enough of a break in there to allow them to get the rest they need to drive safely.
That would be one way to look at it, yes. That would be a correct way to state it. But what's also happening is that shippers and receivers are not held accountable for how long they make a driver wait, which is eating into their allotted hours of time. And if they have used up all of their time, then they are having to race against the clock to get to another delivery, or if they're dealing with bad weather, all of these things come into play that make it difficult for them to get enough rest.
So again, going back to the emergency braking systems, are those systems a priority of your organization, or are they not?
They're not a priority at this time.
Again, people listening to this program are going to be shaking their heads wondering, how can that not be the case?
Well, our priority has been training. We have pushed for decades to get training in place. We think that the best and safest thing that you can put in a truck is a well-trained driver.
What's the cost of this system? Mike said he's hearing about these systems cost a couple of $1,000s. What are you hearing about what the cost is of adding these systems to new trucks coming off the assembly line?
I don't have any data with me.
Okay. A new rig costs, what, $150,000?
Yes.
So this is maybe a couple $1,000s more, something like that?
I don't know.
Okay.
It's like floor mats.
Like what?
It's like adding the cost of floor mats.
It's like 1%, 2% of
correct.
The cost of a new truck.
It's not very much money.
Okay. Our phone number here, we're talking about the safety of big trucks on highways, the lack of emergency braking systems in these new trucks. Our phone number, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Let's go to Keith from Kansas City, Missouri. Keith, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you. I had the fortune of being in Europe about a month ago, and I drove all through Europe, Germany, Austria, Italy. The main number one reason they have safer highways is because all semis and large trucks are required to stay in the right lane. They are not allowed to pass, and they also have limitations marked on each truck on the speed. And I think that trucking companies and organizations might be against that here in America. However, I believe that if we can reduce crashes and also flow the highway better, then it actually could increase their efficiency. And they would probably say no, but, you know, when they get over, it slows down everyone, and also it makes it unsafe because you can't see ahead of you. I mean, anyone that drives down I-70 as much as I do or I-35 knows that every time a truck gets over, you can't see changing road conditions and speed levels. But over in Europe, that never happens. The trucks must stay in the right lane, and it was amazing.
Keith, that's an interesting phone call. Narita Taylor, what do you make of this idea of confining trucks to the right lanes of our nation's highways?
Well, I'm not familiar with how the interstates are laid out in Europe, but I do know that if you were to confine trucks to the right lane on our interstates, you'd have even more congestion because you'd have difficulty for people getting on and off of those interstates if you have them all clogged up with a line of trucks.
Mm-hmm. So you're wondering about that idea then. Okay, Sharon from Kansas City, Missouri. Sharon, you're on Up to Date. We're talking about safety equipment on big semi-trucks. Good morning.
Good morning. I would like to just understand why they don't simply put governors, say at 55 miles an hour, on trucks, and then there wouldn't be this kind of collision activity that we see on our highways.
Mike Hendricks from the Star.
They do have governors on all trucks. They're just not set on all trucks. Many large trucking companies set their governors at 62 miles per hour, something like that. There was a regulation working its way through Washington, in which it would have set the governors at no more than 68, I believe. Mm-hmm. And it died after 10 years or 11 years of wrangling.
So you're saying some trucks have governors, some trucks do not. And the governors limit the maximum speed of a truck, right?
Well, all these big trucks have governors. It's just they're not all of them set them.
Okay. And again, that it regulates how fast a truck can go.
Correct. It would not add a dime to the price of a truck.
Narita.
Sure. That's something that Sure. The issue of speed limiting trucks is something that we've been involved with as well. And what you have to understand is that if you were to limit the speed of trucks to below that of what the rest of the traffic is moving, you're creating what are called speed differentials. And this issue has been studied empirically by a researcher in Arkansas by the name of Steve Johnson. And basically, it would create more crashes by allowing more speed differentials. We have a video about it that kind of explains it a little better.
You're saying it clogs up the highways? Or what's
right.
your point here?
Yeah. Right. You're going to create more congestion and more interactions between vehicles if you are forcing trucks to go slower than the rest of the traffic.
There's some debate over that. And Europe, for instance, limits the speed. They limit the speed in Japan. They limit the speed in Ontario, I believe, in Canada. And there are some highway safety folks who think it's those studies are baloney.
Okay.
I don't know.
Back to some phone calls here. Bob from Liberal, Kansas, out west. Bob, good morning.
Good morning. Hello?
Yeah, go ahead, Bob.
Yeah, I'm a truck driver. I'm driving a truck right now, 2019 Cascadia Freightliner with this crash avoidance technology, and I think they're garbage, and they are definitely not safe.
Why is that?
I could give you... for one thing, I've several times gone under a bridge and all 18 wheels lock up with 80,000 pounds. It's one of the most terrifying things you can imagine. Another thing is I'm still, believe it or not, a better driver than a computer. And there's many situations, especially when the traffic is thick, where I know I can make a certain maneuver and the computer decides I can't. And it will slam on the brakes right in the middle of traffic in the worst situations that create serious hazards. And whenever you take control away from the driver and give it to a computer, or like with the hours of service regulations, we're giving them to people in Washington, D.C., they create a lot of chaos for us out here because they create arbitrary rules and regulations that interfere with my ability to do my job safely and professionally.
So you're saying you have a new model emergency braking system and you don't trust it?
Brand new. Absolutely not. Absolutely. I've almost gotten in two wrecks just within the last few months because of it.
All right, Bob, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Yeah. Let's go back to some calls. Let's go to Michael from Independence. Michael, good morning.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Good. Thanks. Go ahead, Michael.
My question is, my dad's been a truck driver for probably 40-plus years, and I've heard all sorts of different safety equipment and stuff like that. From a training perspective, is there a way that you could put a camera on the outside of the truck, so if an accident were to happen, the trucking companies could figure out, you know, what may have caused it and how to possibly avoid it in the future for training? Because I know, like, my dad's truck got a camera on the inside, so if he does a maneuver that the computer doesn't like, it automatically flashes, records what he's doing, and then sends it to safety. But I don't know if there's anything like that for the outside.
What about video cams, Mike?
Yeah, there's like drive cam cameras that shoot both down the road and inside the cab, so that the companies can later on look at a tense situation. They record a hard braking, and they can go back and find out what happened. Was the driver up ahead's fault or what? And how did the driver respond?
So, Narita, I got 20 seconds left. Your first priority then is to get better trained drivers behind the wheels of these big trucks then.
Better training and more relevant hours of service.
Okay. We'll have to leave our conversation there. It's an interesting issue for sure. I want to thank Narita Taylor, spokeswoman for the Owner Operator Independent Drivers Association, and Mike Hendricks, a Star reporter who wrote the big story in Sunday's paper about these fatal truck crashes across the country. Thank you both very much. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Time for a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about how technology may be not quite what we think it is when it comes to driverless cars and everything else. I'm Steve Kraske. And you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. On yesterday's program, U.S. Representative Kevin Yoder was in studio to discuss the goings-on in Washington and his reelection campaign in Kansas's 3rd Congressional District. You can hear that conversation at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, Human Rights Watch's main point of contact with the American government, Washington Director Sarah Margan, discusses what she calls America's retreat on human rights. Join us for that talk tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, computers land jets atop aircraft carriers. Cars these days can drive without someone behind the wheel. Drones fly without anybody aboard to guide them. Needless to say, new frontiers are emerging when it comes to the interactions between humans and technology. Already, a whole lot of people are wondering if their jobs will be threatened by artificial intelligence and robots. Missy Cummings is at the center of that evolution as director of Duke University's Humans and Autonomy Lab. She's a former Navy fighter pilot. In fact, she was one of the first female fighter pilots who became interested in automation through designing safer military aircraft. And she's not convinced that artificial intelligence is a magic bullet. She speaks at the Linda Hall Library on Thursday night. Missy, welcome. So nice to have you.
Thanks for having me.
You know, you had some experience flying jets that got you interested in this whole realm of the potential of automation. Tell us about that.
Well, I am old enough that I flew A4 Echoes, which were very manual hydraulic powered controls in the aircraft. And then I made the transition to the F-18, which is a fly-by-wire aircraft where the computer is doing all the control instead of the human. And so I got to see this change from the old way of flying planes to the new way of flying planes. And in doing so, I also witnessed a lot of people being killed because they didn't understand how to interpret what the computer was doing to the aircraft. And so that really raised the issue in my head. Wow, computers are now controlling these things. And so how much longer will I actually need to be in the cockpit?
And computers were actually controlling those things, those planes, even better than the humans were, right?
Yes, it's always the computer lands the plane better on the aircraft carrier than a human ever could.
You tell a story about the way computers land planes on the decks of aircraft carriers in such a way as it preserves the life span of the tires on those planes way longer than if a human was landing that plane.
Yes, that's true. In all commercial planes, this is why pilots only touch the stick for anywhere from 3 to 7 minutes of any flight. So whether you're flying for an hour or 18 hours, pilots only touch the controls for just minutes of each of those flights, because when a computer controls the airplane, the airline saves substantial money on gas.
Hmm. So did you ever actually land a jet on the deck of an aircraft carrier? Because that's always amazed me. Or did the computers always do it?
Well, I did it, all my landings were hand-flown. In fact, pilots don't like to use the automation unless they're forced to, because they want to be in the loop. They're very distrustful. And we see that today, even with many automated systems, both in airlines and even driverless cars. The majority of people still are, rightly so, very wary of having the automation drive their car.
In fact, all your work is really focused on this idea of how to get humans to interact more efficiently with the computer to make all these systems work better. Do I have that right?
That is correct.
Yeah. You aren't convinced that artificial intelligence is a cure-all. In fact, you describe it as a tool that can be used to augment and enhance current practices, but it also carries unforeseen risks. That's not what a lot of people think these days. You know, they believe that computers are taking over the world. Why do you disagree?
Well, AI is just a tool in a toolbox, and we're not in the matrix yet. Computers cannot reason on their own. They cannot do what we call inductive reasoning. And that means taking large abstract concepts and making plans from those concepts. They're very data driven. They have to see the world, for example, in pixelated form and then make a guess about what they're seeing, as opposed to thinking in abstract principles. So I would tell you that the ball bouncing in front of the car that most people hear about in driving school is the best example. So when a ball rolls in front of the car, you have an imagination as a human, and you think there is a ball, and because there's a ball, that could be a child nearby, and the child could be in many different places around, whereas the car doesn't have an imagination. Now, you can give a car very specific instructions that if you see this circular object that looks exactly like a ball, then you should put your sensors in certain places to look for a human form, but they don't have the story. Computers can't envision the story that goes around that car and that incident. And so because humans can make more informed guesses with very little information, we're still superior to automation in terms of thinking out of the box.
And so that's why you have lots of issues with driverless cars, for instance. You aren't convinced they should even be on the road yet. Why is that? Because, again, I thought that was the future.
Well, I'm a big fan of the technology of driverless cars, and I think we should be doing the development and working towards that end because humans are such terrible drivers. But I also work in this technology every day, and I know just how deeply flawed it is. And I'll be showing some pictures of how driverless cars do or do not perform at my talk in a day. And so it's really important that people understand this technology is coming. We will one day have driverless cars, but they're actually still extremely experimental. And this is why we saw the death of the pedestrian in Tempe, Arizona, because we're still, as engineers, just learning about these systems. And AI still surprises us almost on a daily basis. And so if a technology is still surprising the engineers that are designing it, that means we're not ready for widespread deployment.
Do you foresee a day when we will have truly driverless cars, or will there always be a component of human interaction with those vehicles?
Oh, no, I'm very, very fatalistic about this. One day we will have driverless cars. I'm even working on flying cars right now, right? So that's further in the future, but we will have what we think of as the Jetsons age technology eventually. But there's still a lot of basic engineering problems that have to be solved before we can do that in a widespread manner.
How long are we looking at, Missy, before we have a true driverless car that's on the highways operating autonomously all by itself?
Well, even that is not quite a clear definition. I think most people think of a true driverless car as one that they can pull out their smartphone, order the car, have the car show up in their front door, jump in the back seat, and sleep as the car takes you to Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
That is 20 to 30 years away.
Wow.
Now, will you be able to potentially order a driverless car and have it take you on a local route that's well modeled and well understood and has extra sensors in the road and maybe takes you to a downtown area of a major urban metropolis? 10 years or less.
Missy Cummings speaks at the Linda Hall Library at 7 on Thursday night. Her topic, From Drones to Flying Cars, New Frontiers in Human Technology Interaction. More information is at the Linda Hall Library website. Just go to lindahall.org. You know, I heard you give a talk once where you raised a whole host of issues about driverless cars. One issue you raised was how easy it is to fool the computers on one of those vehicles into misreading a stop sign for a sign that displays a 45 mile per hour speed limit. I mean, two very different instructions. That was just a little frightening to me.
Yes, I'll be talking about that more at the library event. But this is basically what we call passive hacking. And it shows up not just in driverless car technology, but anywhere where there's computer vision. Because computer vision systems are these than deductive reasoners, if you actually understand how an algorithm picks patterns out of data, then you can actually make pictures then to trick a computer vision system to see something that's not there. And that's because, again, computers do data ground up reasoning and humans do top down abstract reasoning. So we're still trying to figure out then how would we know if, do we even check for that, for example? And how would we know, how would the system be able to tell that in fact there has been some kind of change in the external world that is not real? So again, this is part of the surprising that I talk about. We're still being surprised by the technology. So when it's that big of a surprise to engineers, then we really probably are not ready to put it in the public's hands.
But it does sort of raise questions about the ability to mess with these systems and cause havoc down the road if something like this is possible today.
It's possible. And I, you know, most of this work right now is happening in university labs. And so, but my statement about that is today's university lab trick is tomorrow's Russian hacker tool. So it is important. And it's important not just in driverless cars, but I would tell you the Department of Homeland Security, who thinks that they want to do face recognition and those kinds of technologies. These are very brittle systems. And that means that the systems can be easily fooled. And we're not really sure yet how to develop redundancy inside these systems so that we know for sure that they're not being fooled. I do believe that we will figure this out. I mean, you know, engineers are pretty smart people, but we need more time.
Missy Cummings is my guest. She's director of Duke University's Humans and Autonomy Lab. You point out that cars, more so than planes or trains, are the toughest mode of transportation to automate, and I'm wondering why.
Well, it basically comes down to something we call degrees of freedom. So when you're on a train, you're on a rail, and you know it's really just one direction of travel. And, you know, there could potentially be another train on that rail, which is why we have occasional crashes. But for the most part, the uncertainty is low. Especially if we have sensors in the rails and on the trains, we have absolute certainty about where they are. And so that really reduces the uncertainty. Planes, even though there's the third dimension of altitude, this is a also relatively lower uncertainty environment as compared to driving, because there's, when you're flying in a plane, there's not 50 other idiots just flying inches from you, you know, putting on makeup, eating, texting on their cell phones. And so this is actually the other problem, is because there are so many more vehicles and potentially pedestrians and bicyclists, there's so many other agents that share your same space. And particularly on the highway, at the speeds that we're traveling, that if one person makes one mistake, then there can be a trickle-down effect pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And we just don't get this in the other systems. And because there are so many more objects that have to be tracked in driving, and there's so many degrees of freedom of what people can do, pedestrians and bicyclists are particularly hard for driverless cars to sense and then predict where they're going, because a pedestrian can turn on a dime and bolt across the street in a jaywalking format, or they could go the other way. And same for bicyclists. So that's been a real problem for driverless cars. And obviously, until we get that figured out, it's going to be very difficult for these systems to safely navigate in urban environments.
You know, Missy, your message here today that we are still a number of years away from these technologies being fully implemented and embraced in our society, I think it's going to surprise a lot of people. I think a lot of people think that, you know, these advancements are just around the corner, and you're telling us something very different today. Has society gotten way out over its collective skis as it looks at the future when it comes to technologies like driverless vehicles?
Well, you know, I think it's over-optimism, which is not necessarily a bad thing. I do think in terms of driverless cars, there is a significant amount of hype that's primarily driven by the companies themselves, because there's been over $80 billion invested in getting driverless cars to market, and shareholders want returns on investment. So I do think that there's a business case where people want to see a product come out of these out of this investment. And so I think there's a lot of pressure on the environment to do that. But I would say on the flip side, drones, for example, there tends to be more pushback against drones. And this is actually a very mature technology that we need to see more of. So I'm certainly no Luddite. And I think it really depends on where we are in a technology's maturation cycle as to whether or not we should buy into the hype. You know, we really do need drones, more drones, for example, for first responders, more fire departments, more police units. These are much cheaper technologies that provide them far superior capability and provide levels of safety and investigation that we wouldn't otherwise have. And so we, in that area, we need to relax and not be so heavy-handed in the regulatory market. However, in driverless cars, because it's still a very new technology and we're getting surprised by it on a continual basis, we're not quite ready just to let the technology go in the public sphere.
You know, there's always the potential, it strikes me, for good and for evil with these technologies. One issue you've been asked to deal with is this idea of drones making drops of contraband inside of prisons. I mean, in theory, you might think that could be pretty effective and could cause all kinds of havoc inside of a prison, but you've come up with a way to deal with that. Tell us about that.
So we have been working with the North Carolina prisons to develop a very cheap, low-cost, low-profile acoustic detection system to listen for drones that are being flown in places that they shouldn't be flying. Because it is, there are problems, not just in North Carolina, but across the country, of people dropping contraband, including cell phones and cigarettes, into prison yards, which can cause a lot of problems. So there are technologies out there. The military has some very fancy drone detection devices, which are good if you want to dominate, for example, a frequency spectrum and you have a ton of money. But one of the things that we find is that most of these small venues like prisons and even small sports stadiums that really need to know when there's a drone in their area, they don't have the budgets for the high dollar equipment. So we're working very hard to make small cost, small form factor, easily installed drone listening devices.
And these drones you point out are pretty loud. They make a lot. They're like a little lawnmower up there.
Yeah, we call them flying weed eaters.
They sound sort of like that then, eh?
Yes, very annoying.
You know, you, again, so much of your work deals with sort of how humans and computers can work side by side. One place you do that is by placing computers in the co-pilot seat of airplanes. Explain what you're doing there and what the upside of that is, Missy.
Well, this is part of our spirit of collaborating between humans and computers. I think a lot of people are thinking about replacement. So we hear a lot about driverless cars, that they're being replaced. They want to replace the driver. And, you know, I mean, arguably that's the right idea. We're just not quite there in the technology. But I'm a bigger fan of collaboration between humans and computers. And so one of the projects that we just wrapped up with a company called Aurora Flight Sciences, which is owned by Boeing, is developing a co-pilot, a robotic co-pilot, to help the pilot. Because one of the things that we know is humans in almost all areas can perform really well and some moderate level of workload. When they're bored, they have bad performance. And when they're overworked, they have bad performance. And this is where a robotic co-pilot can really help. So, for example, if it's during a boring phase of flight, you can tell the co-pilot, the robot, to take controls while you go get a cup of coffee. Or similarly, if there's a lot going on, you can tell the robot to turn certain switches and take certain actions so that it allows you to focus on the more important task or for something like communicating and talking with air traffic control. So I think that as a community, in terms of robotics and computer scientists, that we really need to focus more on developing more collaborative agreements and arrangements between the humans and the machines, as opposed to trying to replace people.
Yeah, what does that computer co-pilot look like? Does it actually sit in the seat of where the human co-pilot would normally sit?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's not very cute that we developed with Flight Sciences. It's a robotic arm. So it doesn't really have a personality like BB-8, for example, although maybe one day we will. So, but it has voice and speech recognition. And so it looks just like a big arm that sits in the cockpit. But as robotics becomes more and more mature, you can imagine one day that there would be some kind of humanoid form that potentially could take that. Although I'll tell you, humanoid robot research is still like the holy grail of robot research.
Meaning?
It's really hard to do. Like, you're not going to get that robot made anytime soon, because it turns out cleaning a house is one of the most difficult jobs for a robot to do, because everyone has a slightly different house. Everyone has slightly different arrangements. Everyone likes their dishes put in a certain way, and it's not always the same way. And we all have different dishes. So I think that when people think about cleaning a house, we think of this as really a low wage, low skill task. But in the end, it's the most difficult and will cost the most money to build.
So in what areas of our everyday lives are robots most likely to begin to intersect most often? And where is that going to be?
In well-structured tasks. And so this idea of the DHLs and the UPS aircraft of the world, oh, they're definitely going drone, right? It's a very mature technology, and we know how to do that. So flying robots are on the scale of easy to hard, relatively easy. Some shuttles, slow speed shuttles, they're a little bit more difficult to do. But so, for example, taking a shuttle from an airport into an inner city on a well-established, well-structured route, that's going to be a little bit easier to do and something that you might see in the near term. You've got your robotic vacuums, which are for the most part not that good, but they provide you a little bit of benefit. But you're not going to see, for that day-to-day, you know, robot helping you in your around the house, walking the dog, feeding the cat, those tasks are still light years away from us.
Missy Cummings speaks at the Linda Hall Library at 7 Thursday night. Her topic, From Drones to Flying Cars, New Frontiers in Human Technology Interaction. More information is at the Linda Hall Library website. That's lindahall.org. Missy Cummings, again, is the director of Duke University's Humans and Autonomy Lab. Missy, great conversation. Thanks for taking some time with us today.
Thanks for having me. I'm really looking forward to my visit.
On yesterday's program, we didn't find out who authored the infamous op-ed in the New York Times, but we did learn why and when a publication might choose to run something anonymously. Find our previous episodes at kcur.org/uptodate. Also, you can find us on Twitter. We're at kcuruptodate. Follow me at Steve Kraske, and don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. Tomorrow, what is the Washington branch of the Human Rights Watch keeping its eyes on lately? We'll find out. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Kathleen Pointer. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.